Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into the world of pre-modern Kurdish village life, trying to piece together a picture from historical accounts, ethnographic studies, that kind of thing.
And right away, that term Kurdistan is important. It's a cultural, a linguistic region, yes.
Exactly. Not a unified state. Historically split, really, between the Ottoman and Persian empires.
Which is fundamental. Absolutely fundamental. So when we talk about a typical village, well, it's tricky.
More of a concept than a single reality.
Precisely. You've got huge variations. The landscape itself, mountains versus plains, it makes a difference.
And then the influence, Ottoman versus Persian.
Right. And add to that the different lifestyles, nomadic, semi-nomadic, fully settled, each had its own flavor.
So our goal today is more about finding those recurring patterns, the shared cultural threads.
That's the idea. Draw out the commonalities, but always keeping that diversity, you know, in the back of our minds.
Okay. And to do this, we're using quite a mix of sources.
We are. Ethnographic studies, for instance, like Martin Van Bruinissen's work, Aga, Sheikh in State, really gets into the structures.
The social and political stuff. And then there are these amazing eyewitness accounts, the travelogues.
Oh, they're incredible. Claudius James Rich, early 1800s. Isabella Bird, later that century.
They bring it to life, don't they? That vividness.
They do. But you also have to consider their perspective, their potential biases.
Of course. Yeah. And we're also looking at archaeology for that longer view.
Yes, archaeological evidence helps, and secondary analyses that try to tie it all together. Each source has strengths, limitations.
Travelogues are vivid, but maybe biased. Ethnographies analyze deeply, but reconstruct. Archaeology is tangible, but needs interpretation.
Exactly. So our job is to weave these together, get the most complete picture we can.
Right. So what's the plan for this deep dive? What are we covering?
We'll start with the built environment where people settled, what their homes were like. Then the economy, how they sustain themselves.
The social order, daily life.
Uh-huh. Daily routines, traditions. And finally, how these villages dealt with the big external powers, the Ottomans, the Persians.
Okay, sounds comprehensive. Let's dive in. The built environment. Where did they choose to settle?
Typically, you'd find villages in mountain valleys, maybe on slopes, near water that was non-negotiable. Springs, rivers, vital.
And you mentioned some distinctive layouts, especially in the mountains.
Yes, particularly in places like Haraman. It's quite striking. Houses built incrementally up these really steep slopes.
Or the roof of one house.
It becomes the terrace or courtyard for the house above it. It's a really ingenious adaptation to that terrain.
Wow, yeah, you can picture that. Was it always terraced like that? Or were there other patterns?
No, not always.
Yeah.
You also see villages where houses are clustered together.
And that often reflected kinship,
family
ties.
Very often, yes.
Mm.
Related families living close, forming distinct quarters. But you also see more linear layouts, maybe along a path or water source.
Interesting. And what about central communal spaces, like a village square or a dedicated mosque?
Well, in smaller villages, maybe not so much. Formal structures weren't always there.
Really? So where would they trade or pray?
Evidence suggests they might travel. Go to nearby, maybe larger Armenian or Azerbaijani centers for trade, for example.
Or use Azerbaijani mosques in the Transcaucasus.
Right. And for Yazidis, religious functions often happen in the sheikh's home. It suggests a more, perhaps, decentralized structure in some places or reliance on neighboring communities.
Graveyards, though, they were common.
Yes, graveyards were pretty standard, usually located on the outskirts of the village.
It challenges that automatic image of a village having a clear center. And then, of course, the nomadic groups. Their built environment was tents.
Exactly. The tent con, chadir, reshmal, usually that distinctive black goat hair wool. That was home.
And their settlements were camps, varying in size?
Hugely. From just a few related families to whole clans migrating together with the seasons following the pastures.
Did they have more permanent structures at all?
Sometimes, yes. Their winter camps might include more substantial, sort of semi-permanent tent setups. An adaptation maybe towards a bit more stability even within that mobile life.
Okay, so that gives us a sense of the settlements. Let's look closer at the architecture itself. Materials, construction, what drove their choices?
Two main things. Local materials and the climate. Simple as that.
So in the mountains,
unfinished stone, yeah. Yep. That's what was available, and it gave them sturdy, resilient buildings for that tough environment.
And on the plains or foothills?
Much more likely to be sun-dried mud brick kirpas. Often on stone foundations, though, for stability.
You see volcanic tufa sometimes, too, right? In parts of Armenia.
You do. And wood, though maybe scarce sometimes, was vital for roof beams, those internal support columns, stunning doors, window frames.
And were these typically tall buildings, multi-story?
Generally, no. Mostly single-story, often sprawling horizontally rather than vertically.
And they integrated living spaces with stables, storerooms.
Right. That layout really reflects the agro-pastoral economy. Living quarters, stables, storage, all part of one complex. It shows how central farming and herding were.
Makes sense. You also mentioned underground or semi-underground structures.
Yes, mal or kani. Used sometimes as winter dwellings, fantastic insulation against the cold. Or just in certain regions for a more stable temperature year-round. Mm. Very clever use of the earth itself.
Really efficient. What about the roofs? I imagine they varied a lot.
They really did. Flat roofs were common, especially in drier areas on the plains.
How were they made?
Usually wooden rafters, then layers of reeds or brushwood, topped off with thick packed earth.
And they weren't just for shelter.
No, they were extra living space. Great for drying crops, doing chores, even sleeping out in summer.
But not everywhere. What about mountain areas?
In some mountain regions or places with specific traditions like Haran, you'd see domed or cupola roofs.
With that central opening, the kolek.
Exactly. Served as both a chimney and a skylight. Really ingenious, letting smoke out and light in.
It's amazing how practical needs drive design. What were the interiors like? Simple.
Generally, yes. Packed earth floors were common. The heart of the home was the central hearth, the tandoor.
For heating, but also baking, cooking.
All of that. Essential for daily bread, cooking meals. Sometimes it even had ritual significance.
And those wooden columns, the stun to hold up the roof?
Often necessary, yes. Walls were likely basic mud plaster in many homes.
But Rich, in Sulamania, he described some wealthier homes.
He did. Mentioned whitewashed interiors, which would have been much brighter, and large grassy courtyards.
Divided into public and private areas.
Right. The divan khana for guests, the haram for the family, often with trees and even water channels, those karis or kanats bringing water in. So definitely a spectrum of wealth and comfort.
Yeah, quite a contrast between the basic dwellings and those grander homes. You mentioned regional styles, too.
The landscape just stamped its mark everywhere. Think of the mud brick domes in Haran, totally different from the stone. Terraced villages of Haraman clinging to the mountains.
Or even urban Kurdish houses, like in the Erbil Citadel.
Exactly. Holler. Layer upon layer of history there. It really shows how local factors, stone versus clay, steep slopes versus flat plains, the climate shaped everything.
Okay, so we've got a feel for the physical structures. Let's shift to how they actually sustain themselves. The economy.
The absolute foundation was the agro-pastoral system.
Meaning farming and animal herding together.
But more than just side by side. It was deeply integrated, a symbiotic relationship. And ancient Kurdistan was one of the places where sheep and goats were first domesticated millennia ago.
How did that integration work?
Livestock provided manure for the fields, animal power for plowing, plus milk, wool, hides. Agriculture, in turn, provided fodder for the animals, especially in winter or dry spells.
It's very resilient, self-sufficient.
It was. That diversification, different crops, different animals, plus strategies like transhumance, moving livestock seasonally, helped them weather challenges. It sustained communities for centuries.
And they focused more on live animal products, milk, wool, rather than just meat.
Often, yes. It reflects that long-term subsistence approach. Maximize the ongoing resources. Quite different from later vulnerabilities tied to large-scale, state-imposed monoculture farming.
Right. So what were the typical crops and animals?
Grains were key staples, wheat, barley, often grown in the bigger fields further from the village.
Legumes, too. Chickpeas, lentils.
Vital for diet and good for the soil. Then fruits and nuts in orchards, grapes, pomegranates, figs, apples, olives, dates, almonds, depending on the area, often on hillsides or irrigated plots.
And gardens closer to home?
Yes, for vegetables, herbs, medicinal plants, tomatoes, onions, cucumbers, peppers, that sort of thing.
And livestock, sheep and goats dominant.
By far the most numerous. Cattle were important for milk and draft power, chickens common too.
Yeah.
But sheep and goats were really central.
And the key was integrating all these elements, outfield farming, gardens, orchards, animals, transhumance.
Exactly. Adapting the mix to local conditions, spreading the risk.
Let's dig into those farming practices a bit more. You mentioned diversity of crops.
Yes, that was crucial. Wheat and barley were staples, but you'd find rice, corn in some areas too. Those gardens were vital for daily needs. Orchards, a big feature where possible.
And it all depended heavily on water, rain-fed versus irrigation.
Absolutely. Where rainfall was reliable, they used dime or rain-fed farming, mainly for grains. But in drier areas or for gardens, irrigation was essential.
What did the irrigation look like? Simple ditches?
Could be simple ditches, diverting streams, yes. Or more complex canals, storage basins, especially using water from larger rivers like the Tigris or Euphrates or mountain springs.
And those underground aqueducts Rich saw, the Kariz or Kanat.
Yes. Really sophisticated systems in some places. Effective water management was just fundamental.
And land ownership. How did that work? Was it individual plots, communal land?
It was complex. You had privately held plots, definitely, but also communal pastures, vital for the livestock.
And tribal affiliation mattered.
Hugely. Access to land was often tied to your lineage, your clan. There was a big distinction between tribal Kurds, whose rights came through the tribe, and non-tribal peasants, Gurin or Reya.
Exactly. These groups were often subordinate. They might be sharecroppers, giving a large chunk of their harvest to the tribal landowner, the Aga.
Or even providing unpaid labor, Bagar.
Yes, that happened too. It looked a lot like feudalism in some ways. Landowners held a lot of power over those who worked the land.
Sounds like built-in inequality. Did that change over time?
Well, a major shift happened, especially in the Ottoman areas, with the 1858 Land Code.
What was the aim of that?
The idea was standardization, boosting state revenue, promoting individual ownership. Land had to be registered.
But that ignored traditional communal rights.
Often, yes. What frequently happened was powerful agas, or urban elites, managed to register huge tracts of traditionally communal or tribal land in their own names.
Turning independent villagers into tenants on their own land.
Effectively, yes. It worsened economic divisions, weakened communal ties, shifted power dramatically towards these new landowners.
More impact on the plains than in remote mountains. Generally, yes. Mountain areas sometimes held on to older patterns longer. But it shows how state intervention could really reshape things, often reinforcing inequality.
So alongside agriculture, pastoralism was the other pillar, raising animals.
Absolutely central. Sheep and goats, especially. Perfectly adapted to the mountains, the variable climate.
Cattle less numerous, more for milk and plowing.
Right. And again, the focus was often on maximizing the live animal milk, wool for textiles and tents, manure for fields, not just meat. Long-term thinking.
And this is where transhumance fits in, that seasonal migration.
Exactly. A defining feature, particularly for tribal groups. Moving herds from lower winter pastures, Jermayn or Zozan, up to higher summer pastures, Zoma.
Why move them?
To follow the best grazing, exploit seasonal vegetation, and to avoid overgrazing any one area.
And this involved whole communities moving?
Often entire clans or large parts of tribes. It required serious coordination, knowledge of routes, pasture rights.
So for nomads, life revolved around this movement, living in tents.
Completely. But even settled villagers often practiced a smaller scale version, sending flocks to mountain pastures with shepherds in summer.
So this mobility shaped settlements, society, interactions.
Profoundly. Interactions between nomadic and settled groups could be trade, symbiosis, or conflict over resources.
And for many tribes, wealth and power were tied to their herds.
Very much so, especially in Persia. The size of your flock was a direct measure of status.
Beyond farming and herding, what about crafts? Local production.
Crafts were important, especially weaving by women. Carpets, kilims, saddlebags, textiles from their own wool, mainly for home use, but also for trade.
Other crafts, too, to meet local needs?
Presumably, yes. Basic carpentry, maybe some metalwork for tools, leatherworking, things needed for daily life in the village.
And trade, how connected were these villages? Were they selling a lot externally?
Trade networks seem mostly localized. Many villages were largely self-sufficient for basics.
But they did trade for things they couldn't make or sell surplus.
Yes. Villagers would travel to nearby market towns. Or sometimes trade occurred in ethnically different villages, like Armenian or Azerbaijani ones in the Transcaucasus.
Seasonal markets, too.
Right. Regional centers sometimes hosted seasonal markets, where different groups came together. But the core economy was village subsistence, supplemented by limited regional trade, not deep commercial integration.
Okay, let's shift focus now to the social order itself. How is society structured?
For many Kurds, the absolute fundamental unit was the tribe, the Ashret. That was your primary identity, the basis for political organization.
Based on descent, patrilineal.
Primarily patrilineal, yes. Tracing lineage through the male line, though outsiders could sometimes be incorporated.
And tribes had internal divisions.
Yes, a segmentary structure, like nested boxes. Large tribes divided into sub-tribes, then clans, Tyre, Taif, Kabile, Ficht, down to lineages, Hawes, Bavik, all made of related households.
Were these divisions rigid?
Not always. Boundaries and loyalties could shift. This structure could fuel internal feuds, but also enable collective action against outsiders.
And above the tribes, historically, there were the emirates, Mirati or Hukumet.
Exactly. In many areas, you had these larger, semi-independent principalities ruled by hereditary Kurdish dynasties, the Birs, Botan, Soran, Baban, Hakkari. Ardalan are famous examples.
And they had autonomy under the Ottomans or Persians.
Significant autonomy, yes, what? From the 16th century onwards. They ran their own affairs, courts, taxes, armies, mostly tribal levies, in exchange for loyalty and border defense.
A long-standing system, what changed?
The 19th century. Ottoman and Qajar centralization efforts aimed to dismantle them. Replace local rule with direct imperial control.
Through force. Politics.
Both. They wanted to break that hereditary power, appoint their own officials, integrate Kurdistan fully.
Which led to resistance, uprisings.
Kurdish leaders fought to keep their autonomy. But the tribal divisions, that segmentary nature, often made unified resistance difficult. The empires could exploit internal rivalries.
And the fall of the Emirates created a power vacuum.
It did, which lower-level agas and significantly religious leaders, sheikhs, often filled.
Okay, so within that tribal framework, let's talk kinship and marriage. Bedrock of society, you said.
Absolutely. Defined identity, relationships, inheritance, property. Overwhelmingly patrilineal.
And marriage wasn't just personal. It had social, economic, political functions.
Very much so. Mm. It was a key institution for managing the lineage and tribe.
What were some common marriage patterns? Arranged marriage.
That was the norm. Families negotiated matches, often to ensure lineage interests, maintain order, forge alliances.
And that preference for marrying a cousin, the father's brother's daughter.
Patrilateral parallel cousin marriage, yes. A very strong preference. The man often had first rights to her. It kept property within the immediate male line, reinforced solidarity.
Endogamy, too. Marrying within the tribe or lineage.
Yes. Often preferred or expected. To maintain group purity, cohesion, traditions. Especially crucial for groups like the Yazidis with strict rules.
What about bride price? Next or Keelan?
A significant practice. Groom's family paid the bride's family, compensating for the loss of her labor, legitimizing the marriage. But the bride herself usually got no share.
Was there an alternative?
Exchange marriage. Pegahirk. A direct swap of women between two families. Eliminated bride price, created strong reciprocal ties.
And customs like levirate and sororate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Levirate. A widow marries her deceased husband's brother, kept her supported, kept property in the lineage. Sororate. A widower marries his deceased wife's sister, provided a mother figure, maintained the family alliance.
It really highlights marriage as a collective strategic decision.
Absolutely. That FBD preference consolidated property, but maybe weakened wider ties, contributing to factionalism. Bride price benefited the bride's family. Exchange marriage built strong alliances. Levirate sororate reinforced the lineage above all.
And the wife typically moved to the husband's family, patrilocal residence.
That was the norm, yes. Often leading to extended family households. Polygyny was allowed by Islam, but likely uncommon due to the economic cost. Kinship and marriage were just woven into that patriarchal tribal structure.
So we've mentioned emirs and tribal leaders at the village level who held day-to-day authority.
Primarily two types of figures, agas and sheikhs.
Agas being the secular leaders.
Right. Their authority came from the tribal hierarchy, heads of villages, clans, sometimes larger groups, often hereditary, but also dependent on personal influence, wealth, skill in conflict, and mediation.
What did they actually do?
Presided over councils, judged disputes, led warriors, represented the community to outsiders, and crucially, maintained hospitality in the guest house, the diwan. Many were also big landowners, giving them economic clout.
Their power varied.
Yes, depending on their group size, status, like Bigzad, noble lineages, and how much state control there was locally.
And the sheikhs, religious leaders.
Yes. Their authority came from piety, knowledge, Sufi connections.
Yeah.
Kari Naqshbandi orders were strong, maybe revered ancestry, or just a reputation as a holy person.
And their influence could cross tribal lines.
Often, yes. That made them valuable mediators in feuds, enhancing their political role, especially after the Emirates declined in the 19th century. Figures like Sheikh Ubaidullah or Sheikh Zayed mobilized huge followings, sometimes challenging the state, using that religious authority.
So how did agas and sheikhs interact? Rivals, allies?
It was complex. Could be rivals, could be allies. often operated in distinct but overlapping spheres. It created alternative routes for influence, dispute resolution, political action, a key dynamic.
Sounds like there were clear social divisions beyond just leadership.
Definitely not homogenous. Big internal stratification. A key split was between tribally organized Kurds, the Usherette, focused on lineage, tribal politics, often pastoralism.
And the non-tribal groups. Guran, Rea, Piskin.
Exactly. These were usually settled farmers, villagers, artisans, often politically, economically subordinate to the dominant tribes.
How subordinate?
Lacking tribal protection, they were often subject to agas. Paid tribute, worked as sharecroppers, maybe did unpaid labor, bigar.
And this distinction could be quite sharp.
In some areas, yes. The Guran near Sulaimania, for example, were sometimes seen almost as a different people by warrior tribesmen focused on farming, not fighting.
Was it purely exploitation, or was there any mutual benefit?
Could be exploitative, but also some symbiosis. Peasants provided goods, labor, tribes offered protection, market access, but the power imbalance favored the tribes.
It underlines the complexity, not just one unified Kurdish identity back then.
No. Inherent inequalities based on lineage, lifestyle, power, predating modern class divisions.
With tribes, honor, lineage, conflict seems inevitable. Was feuding common?
Blood feud, Gutswin, was endemic in tribal society, deeply tied to honor, collective responsibility.
Triggered by a killing.
Yes, intentional or accidental. Vengeance was seen as essential to restore the kin group's honor.
And the target wasn't just the killer.
No, the principle was collective liability. Any male member of the killer's lineage could be targeted. An offense against one was an offense against the group.
Sounds like it could spiral, last for generations.
Easily. Creating deep-seated animosity. The scope depended on the social distance between the groups involved.
Was there any way to stop it? Mediation.
Mediation was crucial to prevent total destabilization. Respected agas from neutral groups, paramount chiefs, and especially sheikhs acted as mediators.
Sheikhs, again, because of neutrality.
Often, yes. Their spiritual authority placed them slightly outside the immediate rivalry.
How did mediation end a feud?
Usually with payment of blood money, bez, from the killer's kin to the victim's family. The amount was negotiated. Status, circumstances, power, all played a role. Acceptance meant the feud was over.
So feuding was disruptive, but the system also reinforced group ties.
Paradoxically, yes. It reinforced reliance on your lineage for protection, and the mediation process highlighted the leader's role in maintaining some kind of order.
Okay, let's shift to daily life. What did a typical day involve, and how are roles divided between men and women?
Life followed the seasons, the agro-pastoral rhythm. Work was generally gendered, though with overlap, surely.
Men doing the heavier farm work. Plowing, harvesting.
Yes, transport, trade, and public life politics, conflict resolution.
And women focused on the household. Childcare, cooking.
Cooking, especially that daily bread in the tandoor. Weaving, fetching water, gathering fuel, home maintenance. Peasant women likely helped with lighter farm tasks, too.
Wealthier women, less so.
Probably more focused on managing the household, maybe with servants. Nomadic women had huge roles in camp management, milk processing, livestock care during migrations.
And daily routines, marked by prayers, meals, socializing.
Calls to prayer in Muslim areas, yes. Family meals. And for men, socializing often happened in that village guest house.
Rich, noted women seemed quite visible in Sulaimania. Moving freely.
He did. Performing domestic tasks openly in courtyards. It suggests perhaps less strict seclusion than in some other contemporary societies.
The guest house keeps coming up. Mavenkain, Diwan. Clearly vital.
Absolutely a cornerstone.
Yeah.
Usually run by the Aga. It had multiple functions.
Hospitality first. Shelter. Food for travelers.
Yes. Generosity to strangers was paramount. The quality of the guest house reflected the Aga's status, his reputation.
But it was more than just a hotel. It was the village social hub.
For men, yes. Daily gatherings, exchanging news travelers brought information, discussing local issues, settling minor disputes, making community decisions.
A place for storytelling, too. Listening to bards, Dengbas.
Definitely. Socializing, learning traditions, history, etiquette from elders. It was the public forum, council chamber, info center, social club, rolled into one. Reinforced the Aga's role, built cohesion. Rich's own reception shows how important it was.
Given limited literacy, oral tradition must have been huge.
Absolutely paramount. Preserving history, values, entertainment, all done orally.
And the Dengbejeas were central to that.
Hugely. These bards, itinerant or resident, were masters of epic songs, kilim, stories. Siroc, often performed unaccompanied.
What did they sing about?
Heroism, battles, love, history, the landscape itself. They were living libraries of collective memory. Vital at gatherings, weddings, winter evenings, performances could last hours.
Regional styles too, like Saya Cheshman and Howerman.
Exactly. Specific traditions in different areas.
And music and dance, integral to celebrations.
Very much so. Especially weddings, which could last days. Group dances, traditional instruments, or just singing and clapping. Communal participation.
Festivals too. Like Pirshalyar, Newroz.
Yes, ancient local festivals like Pirshalyar and Ahriman. And traditional forms of Newroz, the Kurdish New Year, with pre-Islamic roots. Plus religious holidays, Bayram or Eid, were major events.
We touched on religion earlier. Sunni Islam majority, but diverse.
Majority Sunni Shafi, yes. But significant Alevi, Yazidi, Arsani communities. Plus historical Christian and Jewish presence. Complex interactions.
And religion permeated daily life. Religious figures influential.
Deeply. Sufi sheikhs, revered saints, Santas Kemeters, Sayyids commanded great devotion, held social and political influence.
Sufi orders like Naqshbandi and Qadiri were important.
Very deeply rooted. Provided spiritual guidance, social networks, sometimes a basis for political action.
And daily practices. Prayers, mosque attendance, Sharia law.
Daily prayers, mosque attendance where possible. Sharia influenced personal status laws. Pilgrimages, like to Lalish for Yazidis, were vital. Religious identity was complexly interwoven with tribal and ethnic identity, sometimes unifying, sometimes dividing.
The empires had to navigate this diversity.
They did. It was part of the administrative challenge.
What about material culture? Clothing? Adornment?
Traditional clothing had common elements, but regional variations adapted to climate and lifestyle.
For men, baggy trousers, vest, sash?
Yes. Shawl, trousers, shirt, yellick, vest, maybe a jacket. That wide cloth sash piston shawl was practical for support, carrying things. Headwear important to turban, semidani, or other cloth.
Materials, colors.
Often local wool cotton, but sometimes imported fabrics. Often vibrant colors, pink, yellow, scarlet mentioned. Tassels, fringes, regional styles too, like the kolabal jacket in Harriman.
And for women.
Long dresses, kruts, over trousers, derpe. Mm-hmm. Vests or jackets common. Head covering, scarves. Dim elastic, especially for married women.
Colorful, adorned.
Often colorful, especially younger women. Beads, sequins, embroidery. Older women might wear darker colors. Jewelry, especially gold, Caleb often part of marriage, was important for adornment and wealth. Tattoos were traditional in some communities for both sexes.
So clothing marked region, status, identity.
Clearly. A visible marker.
Okay, these villages didn't exist in a vacuum. How did they fit into the big picture under Ottoman and Persian rule?
Well, from the early 16th century, Chaldiran 1514, Kazari Shirin 1639, Kurdish lands were basically split between them.
A complex relationship, balancing local autonomy and imperial control.
For centuries, yes. Indirect rule was common. The empires found direct control difficult, costly, given the terrain and tribal independence.
So they let local Kurdish rulers, mirs, agas, run things?
Largely, yes. In return for keeping order, acknowledging sovereignty, paying some tribute, sometimes waived, and crucially, providing military support, especially on the frontiers.
A mutually beneficial arrangement for a while.
For a long time. Empires secured borders relatively cheaply. Kurdish elites kept power.
Until the 19th century, centralization changed everything.
That was the turning point. Ottoman Tanzimat, Qajar reforms driven by internal needs, European influence aimed to eliminate autonomous rulers, establish direct control.
Dismantle the emirates, new taxes, integrate territories fully.
Exactly. Replace hereditary rulers with appointees. This shift from negotiated autonomy to direct rule sparked widespread Kurdish resistance. Uprisings led by figures trying to preserve their power.
Before that centralization push, how did those emirates actually govern?
They were the main large-scale Kurdish political units, Botan, Soran, Baban, etc. The mirs held considerable power.
Had their own courts, collected taxes, commanded troops.
Yes. Courts, modeled on imperial ones, administering local justice, collected tax tribute, commanded armies, mostly tribal levies. They had advisors, councils. Rich describes the court in Sulaymaniyya.
So they were regional power centers, cultural hubs too.
Often, yes. Patrons of art sometimes. They represented Kurdish power regionally, mediating between tribes and empires. Their destruction was a huge loss of self-rule.
What were the main demands the empires placed on Kurds? Taxes and military service.
Those were the main ones. Tax levels varied. Sometimes exemptions were given for loyalty or military duty.
And military service was key. Kurdish cavalry.
Very important. Kurdish tribes were renowned fighters, knew the terrain, often provided irregular cavalry sepai for the Ottomans, crucial for policing that Ottoman-Persian border.
And later the Hamidi regiments.
Great 19th century, yes. Ottoman tribal cavalry, mostly Kurdish, meant to boost control in the east, counter Armenians, Russians.
Did participation benefit Kurdish leaders?
It could bring status, resources, but imperial demands could also be heavy, cause grievances, especially as demands for taxes and conscripts rose with 19th century state building. That fueled resistance.
And relationships with neighbors. It was a diverse region. Armenians, Assyrians, Arabs, Turks, Persians.
Extremely diverse. Interactions were multifaceted, could be peaceful coexistence, economic symbiosis, or rivalry, conflict, dominance.
How did tribal Kurds interact with settled farmers, maybe of different ethnicities?
Often through trade pastoral goods for grain, or sometimes political dominance, extracting tribute from peasant villages.
Economic interdependence was common. Kurds and Armenian artisans, for instance.
Yes, definitely. Huh. But competition over resources, land, water, plus old grievances and manipulation by the empires could easily spark friction, even violence.
Imperial policies sometimes worsen things, like using Kurdish forces against Armenians.
That's a complex and tragic example. Though Kurdish responses varied, it shows how empires could exploit divisions. Intergroup dynamics were shaped by local economics, social structures, and imperial politics.
So the big picture is location on the edge of empires, centuries of indirect rule, then disruption by 19th century centralization.
That's a good summary. That shift from autonomy to direct control transformed state-village relations, eroded traditional power, and often led to conflict.
It sounds like life presented a constant stream of challenges.
It really did. Just managing resources in that tough landscape was a perpetual challenge.
Yeah.
Adapting farming and herding to the terrain, climate, rainfall.
Water management being critical.
Absolutely vital, especially outside rain-fed areas. Those irrigation systems, simple or complex like the Kurese, were essential. Control over water could mean cooperation or conflict.
But the traditional agro-pastoral system was itself an adaptation for sustainability.
A sophisticated one, yes. Diversity, integration, transhumance, all aimed at managing risk. But pressures like population growth, drought, external demands could still strain resources, cause soil erosion. Later, things like dams had huge impacts too.
And security challenges, internal feuds, external threats.
Constant concerns. Internally, those blood feuds could be incredibly disruptive, weakening communities, even with mediation systems in place.
And externally, raids, state power.
Raids from rival tribes over pasture, water, livestock. Clashes between nomads and settled groups. And vulnerability to state power, punitive expeditions for taxes or control could be devastating. Displacement, loss of life. British bombing in the 1920s is an extreme later example.
So villages needed to be vigilant, rely on themselves.
Manpower, tribal solidarity, sometimes fortifications. Rich mentioned guards and patrols in Sulaymaniyah. Defense was a necessity.
And finally, that challenge of state intervention and modernization in the 19th century.
Yes, accelerating pressures. Abolishing emirates removed familiar authority, replaced by state bureaucrats who might not understand or care about local issues.
The land code changing ownership.
Dispossessing people, concentrating land with elites, new taxes, conscription, forced settlement of nomads, all disrupted traditional life and norms.
Which provoked resistance.
Often, yes. From tax revolts to major uprisings. But there was adaptation, too. Leaders learned to navigate the new systems. New communications, transport slowly broke down isolation.
So it was a period of forced adjustment, conflict, transformation.
Exactly. These villages were always in a dynamic, balanced environment, internal society, external states. The 19th century really tilted that balance.
Right. So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's try to summarize the key takeaways about pre-modern Kurdish village life.
Okay. We saw villages strategically placed, society based on kinship and tribe, an adaptable agro-pastoral economy. Local leadership often shared between agas and sheikhs.
Hospitality and honor were core values, and they constantly navigated life under the Ottoman and Persian empires.
Right. Balancing autonomy and submission, but facing huge challenges.
Managing resources, internal feuds, external threats, and then that growing pressure from state intervention and modernization.
Exactly. Constant adaptation was the name of the game.
And important to stress again, huge regional variation, not one single experience.
Absolutely critical. Geography, imperial influence, lifestyle, settled nomadic, religion, all created differences. But still, those common underlying patterns emerge.
How does this history connect to today, to contemporary Kurdish society?
Profoundly. Tribal identities, traditional codes, kinship ties, they still matter in many places. The memory of this distinct cultural past is powerful. Understanding this pre-modern village life is really foundational for grasping modern Kurdish history, identity complexities, and ongoing struggles.
It definitely adds that deeper context. So a final thought for our listeners to take away.
Maybe consider this. How might the historical experiences of these villages, that long practice of balancing local autonomy against external control, adapting to tough environments, navigating internal divisions, how might that resonate with the challenges and aspirations of stateless peoples or marginalized communities all around the world today?
That's definitely something to ponder. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.